Republican John Huffman, who's running for re-election in Oregon's 59th district. He talked with Don about his constitutant. His constituents, his family, and his level of frustration over how he feels the legislator is sometimes sidelined. Stay tuned at 6:30 for Don Gavitt, a Democrat and Portland public school teacher running for the Oregon House. In the 42nd district, he talked with Don Mayer about what he plans to bring to the legislature as a teacher and what he wants to bring his students and their parents as a legislator.
I'm Don Mayer, and I'm talking with Republican John Huffman. Mr. Huffman is running for re-election in Oregon's 59th district. Mr. Huffman, thanks for talking with me.
You bet. Thanks, Don.
First question I wanted to ask you is, I see that you have a lot of very varied experience. You had an orchard, you've worked on cars, but the experience I'm most interested in is your broadcasting experience. Tell me a little bit about that. How did you get into radio?
I had been managing a Ford Mercury dealership in Missouri and ended up in Oregon and had an opportunity to step into Q104 radio in the Dalles, Oregon, 100,000 watt FM, and step in as the sales manager. And a few months later, the absentee owner from Southern California called me up and said that he wanted me to become the GM. And so that started a long relationship. He also happened to have a pear orchard in the Parkdale, Oregon area. And I got stuck managing that along with the radio station. So it was kind of a weird conglomerate of businesses that I ended up running.
Okay. I have been reading that land is much more valuable if it's developed than if it's being used strictly for farmland. But I know on the east side also big companies like Google and Facebook have moved in. And I'm just wondering, do farmers who are maybe looking to get out of family farming look at that and say, well, maybe there's a way I can attract big business to buy up my land and I can go do something else?
Well, with the land use rules that we have in Oregon, it would be difficult for a farmer to sell their property for another use, industrial, if it's not zoned industrial.
You've been representing House District 59 since 2007.
Right.
What do you feel has been some of your most significant accomplishments for your constituents during that time in office?
Probably the best work we did was keeping some really bad bills from getting passed. And whether you're looking at business, agriculture, in anything that you can think of where legislation can be targeted at a particular category, you know, if we can stop overregulation, for example, at the end of the day, I think that's a good thing.
Okay. So, and you're running for re-election.
I am.
So, for the people who are looking at the crop of candidates vying for public office, what makes your candidacy special?
Well, you know, I think probably the large part, other than the fact that I fit my district well and I am well-liked, in my last several re-elections, I usually get 60 to 70% of the vote. So I have a good base of support there. So not only reflecting my district well, regardless of party affiliation, but also, after you've been in office for a year or so, you build up relationships. And I do a lot of constituent work. And if you've got relationships with state agency folks, it's a lot better for your constituents. When it comes campaign time, of course, I'm an old broadcaster, and so I rely heavily upon radio. But I also do print ads. I do mass mailers. But I think mostly for me, I'm really out, not just at campaign time. So whenever the opportunity arises, I try to be available so that whether it's young people or middle-aged people or elected officials or just other constituents that have never met me or they're in need, I try to be available.
Two tax-related ballot measures passed in 2010, ballot measure 66 and 67. Ballot measure 66 would have raised, did raise, the amount of tax on personal households, and 67 raised the corporate minimum tax. My assumption is that as a Republican, your concerns are lower taxes rather than higher taxes.
I would say my view, I'm not opposed to taxes. I understand that the state needs taxes. We need revenue to provide the necessary services and services that a lot of Oregonians want. But I do support balance, and I think you can get too high on your taxes and you start confiscating money from folks in an inordinate amount. One of the things I try to look at is spending. You know, do we need to raise taxes or do we need to get spending under control? And I'm certainly not opposed to either one of them. We just need to find the balance.
I was looking at some of the traditionally hot topic areas for Oregonians, and I wanted to sort of go through a list, and maybe you'd give me your thoughts on each one of them. The first one is timber, and that's sort of related to what we were talking about earlier. Oregon has gotten a lot of money in the past from its timber sales, but those are being cut back.
Right.
And so the state needs to find new sources of revenue. And I just wanted to ask you, how are the two connected in as you see it?
Well, I see a lot of our rural communities drying up, as particularly the timber mills have shut down over the years. Younger families have moved out of those areas and into the more metropolitan areas to find jobs. And I think we can do a lot better in this state managing our natural resources in a balanced way. I think the conservation community and the business community can come to the table and there can be agreement. I think we've got a bright future in the state in managing our forests properly and doing great thinning projects, which gets the logs to the mills and provides jobs in rural parts of Oregon without totally destroying our ecosystem. I think we can do a lot better job in all of our resource management than what we've been doing. And we really have to get, and I know there's a lot of effort from Senator Wyden and Congressman Walden and Schrader and DeFazio and others. We can do a lot better job at trying to manage our timber, particularly our federal lands, better. We have a lot of federal forests that, frankly, are not being managed properly. And I'm not suggesting that you go in there and rape and pillage the land, but there's got to be a better way of managing so that we eliminate the undergrowth and the severe fires that we get in our forests and still have an economy based on proper forest management at the same time.
Well, you're talking about management on sort of a macro level, but for the communities that have relied for decades on timber sales, how do they shift their economies to be more sustainable?
A lot of people like to suggest that, well, you switch to tourism, you switch to a service-based industry. But the reality is the service industries are $10 an hour jobs or $12 an hour jobs, not the $20 or $30 an hour jobs. Now, in a lot of what used to be my district prior to the legislative redistricting a couple of years ago, I represented all of the wind areas. I had Sherman and Gillum County where the original wind farms started going in and on out into Morrow County. And so that has been quite a boon for the economy out there. A lot of $25 an hour jobs have come along with the wind farms because for every, 7 to 9 wind turbines that you see out east, that represents one full-time maintenance job, permanent, ongoing. And so that's been a real help. Of course, there are no forests in Sherman County, for example, and in Gillum County. And so those jobs weren't replacing the timber industry jobs. But what you would see happen, some of the folks out of Wheeler County that lost timber jobs were able to move up and retrain and move into Sherman and Gillum County and take some of those wind jobs.
Another one of the hot button topics for Oregon is medical marijuana. Now, right across the border in Washington, the state's just legalized the use of marijuana for personal use and spent a lot of time setting up an infrastructure for retail outlets to sell marijuana as well as medical marijuana dispensaries. And, you know, if Oregonians want, they could just cross the border and, you know, buy marijuana for their own use. Meanwhile, Oregon has been pretty resistant to the idea of marijuana, either for personal use or for medicinal use. So I was wondering, what are your thoughts about the use of marijuana, the legalization of marijuana, And do you think it could be used as a tool to help reduce the state's deficit?
I don't discredit the use of marijuana for medicinal purposes at all. I do think our medical marijuana program has gotten out of hand, and I think there are a lot of aches and pains that are being treated with quote-unquote medicinal marijuana that maybe is a little far-reaching. It's going to be interesting. Frankly, I'm looking to Washington and Colorado right now to see kind of how this plays out in those states. It's interesting living in the Gorge for the last almost 30 years, right on the border of Washington. It's interesting to see how policies play out, or when Oregon does something and Washington doesn't, or vice versa. It's interesting to see how that plays out in the other state, because like you said, it is awful easy just to cross over the border. We've seen it, liquor retailer in Hood River and the Dalles. I had lunch with him the other day, and I said, so how is the new liquor control program in Washington playing out for you right along the border? And he said, it's been a boon for me. I get a lot of Washington customers coming over because liquor is cheaper in Oregon. Now that Oregon is looking, and ballot measures have been filed with the Grocery Association looking at trying to do maybe something similar to what Washington did with liquor, how will that play out in Oregon? It's going to be interesting to see where that ends up, and how will it affect my constituent in the Gorge that has the liquor retail store. As far as legalizing it, though, I'm going to be keeping an eye on Washington and Colorado in the numbers for driving incidences. When you are impaired, whether on the job or driving, that can be from alcohol, marijuana, other drugs, prescription drugs. And so I think it's difficult to just look at marijuana only. My opinion is we need to approach it very cautiously, and just to look at marijuana as a potential revenue source, I don't do that, because there are too many other side effects we need to look at. And federal law, you know, how does that play into it? And will the feds continue to kind of ignore what states are doing when they pass state-level laws? It'll be interesting.
I want to ask you about some of the labor issues now. Governor Kitzhaber has been instrumental in helping negotiate a deal between labor unions at Terminal 6. It took a year or more for two jobs to get moved, and what that succeeded in doing was spooking one of the major shippers that represents more than 75% of the terminal's business. At the same time, earlier in the year, the governor called a special session to try to make some concessions to keep Nike in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, I'm sure people are looking across the border in Washington and seeing what happened when union workers for Boeing turned down a contract, and now Boeing is being courted from all over the country.
That's right.
So I guess one of the questions I want to ask you is, what do you think about the relationship between where government and labor intersect, and how can it be made to operate a little smoother so the fortunes of the state can be a little less turbulent?
Well, a lot of that, frankly, seems to come through the governor's office, and with his authority and his ability to be able to get people to the table to negotiate. Collective bargaining is typically within a local bargaining unit and is seldom touched by the legislature. So I watch those things with interest, but we don't really get involved a lot in those. More where we deal with labor and labor issues inside the building is more from a bonding and economic development standpoint. It has been interesting to watch, though, whether it's state employee unions or whether it's AFL-CIO or anybody else, you know, dealing with the port issues. When one side or the other gets out of balance and wants more than the other side can or is willing to give, we have problems.
You talked a little bit about collective bargaining between labor unions. I want to talk a little bit about now collective bargaining for state employees. In some states, especially in Michigan right now, with the issue of the bankruptcy of
in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. The state has been accused that they are violating the Constitution by changing the terms of the agreement that employees would get a set amount for retirement and that their retirement would not be touched. Now, that is a legislature issue.
I keep a really close eye on what other states are doing. Now, I have supported the small PERS reforms that we have done in Oregon this year, watching with interest to see what the Supreme Court comes up with, if they're going to uphold.
The Oregon Supreme Court.
Yes, the Oregon Supreme Court uphold the PERS reforms that we passed during the special session or not. The jury, so to speak, is still out on that. So we'll see if that effort was worthwhile or not. Again, I kind of go back to the balance approach. When I look at state employees, all state employees are not equal. We have some state employees making $20-some thousand a year, and we have some state employees making six figures. And so when you look at PERS reform, I'm extremely cautious because I think you can cripple the lower income state employees. So one answer, one size fits all, is usually not going to be the answer when it comes to PERS reform. But one of the frustrations that I have had, and I've been vocal about being a Ways and Means member, is that when it comes to supplying the money, appropriating the money to state agencies or K-12 money that ends up getting divided up into school districts, you know, all of these entities have done their own collective bargaining. They have made their own agreement in how much they're going to increase employee benefits. But at the end of the day, at the end of the biennium, they come back to me with their handout and say, well, here's our budget and we need to fill this. So that's the only time until really this year that I've had a voice in how much we pay out. A big part of our PERS problem has been with local school districts. And so I've wondered, you know, is that an area that maybe we should have statewide collective bargaining where there's one focal point of responsibility where, you know, we've shifted after ballot measures 5 and 50 where the legislature is responsible through the general fund of supporting most of the K-12 budget, where prior to those it was a lot more of it came out of the local tax base. So when it comes to collective bargaining and benefits and meeting the state budget, I do think we can do better. And I would like to look at areas that maybe we can get more of a common sense approach to meeting budgets.
I want to ask you now a little bit about Cover Oregon and the Affordable Care Act. By any measure, the rollout of both of those programs has been disappointing, but yet there are still millions of Americans who don't have health care. And I wanted to ask you what you think needs to be done to help meet the needs of those millions of Americans and thousands of Oregonians who are without health care. Do you think it's a matter of making sure that we do everything we can to make the programs that have been put in place work as well as they can, or do you think it's a matter of returning to or taking a second look at what we had before those programs are put in place? I just want to get your thoughts on that.
I didn't support the health care transformation bill in 2011 here in the Oregon legislature. And I largely haven't supported the Affordable Care Act. And the reasons are I was headed down a different road when it came to health care reforms. I support the effort, and I don't know that it's going to be possible. It certainly wouldn't be easy to undo everything and go back. And I don't know that the majority of the people want that done. But I do harbor some feelings. You know, it was frustrating when I felt that there were 7 to 10 different things that we could have done. We could have expanded the high-risk pool. We could have, which we still haven't addressed, tort reform, portability of products where you have ownership of the policy and it's more like automobile insurance and it's transportability across state lines. You know, there were things like that that we could have done to address healthcare, to drive the cost down, and we didn't. We chose to do a total transformation. But it's having said that, at the same time, I'm cautious whether it's healthcare or anything else. I'm not the type of legislator or politician that goes out and points fingers. I don't like to go, well, look, see, I told you so. No, you know, I'm a team player. We've made the decisions. We're moving forward, and we just need to make it work now. You know, is it legal for the governor and the insurance commissioner to extend the deadline without coming back to the legislature for approval? Do they really have the constitutional legal authority to do that? Probably not, in my opinion. I'm not an attorney, but I really question whether the governor has the authority to do that. But there wouldn't have been any problem for the governor to have called us back into special session and say, hey, look, we have a problem. We need an extension.
You've made a couple of references to something that I want to just draw out just a little bit more.
My level of frustration?
You strike me as a moderate Republican. And I'm just wondering, how does that work for you in terms of being able to continue to see both sides? I mean, obviously, you've been reelected more than once in your district, so your constituents must feel that. So I'm just wondering, how do your colleagues feel?
Well, I think most people, whether it's my constituents or Oregon as a whole or in the legislature, I think most people want somebody that's going to be reasonable and trying to achieve balance. Now, I understand that my definition of balance may be different than your definition of balance, and it probably is. But at least somebody trying to be reasonable and come to the table, and again, like I said before, not point fingers, but say, hey, what do we have in common here, and where do I need to give and where do you need to give? Is there a willingness to give? I know Paul Ryan has really been taking a lot of heat this past week, getting together with Senator Murray, coming up with compromise. You know, probably the far right and the far left, neither one are happy with the deal. And I've often said, if the far right and the far left are both really displeased about something, then it's probably close to what needs to be. I think we have become a lot more polarized in particularly federal politics, but I've seen it in state politics also. There are groups on both sides of the issue that are making it challenging to be a balanced legislator, whether you know, you call it a moderate legislator or whatever.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the issue with some parents in Portland Public Schools. Some parents have accused the Portland Public Schools of not teaching their children according to the way the schools are mandated to teach them for the hours that they're mandated to teach them for. And I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts regarding that? Because the state does have a responsibility, according to the Constitution, the state has a responsibility to provide free education to the children of the state. And some parents are saying that state's not doing that.
It kind of goes back to the definition of balance. What is the proper public education? I've served on the House Education Committee ever since I got in the legislature, almost 6.5 years. And I've run into this a lot. There are varying opinions between, even within professional educators. There's a lot of opinion out there about if my school district only provides 4 days a week of classroom education, is that enough? Or does the law, is the intent that it should be 5 days a week? Is 7 hours a day at school enough, or should it be 7.5 or 8? I have always been very strong local control, and so I leave that up to the individual communities and the individual school boards to try to meet the needs of their community and the desires of their community, their business leaders, and their parents. But I also am very hard on the school board members and the administration, saying it's incumbent upon you that you need to listen carefully to what your parents and your community is saying. And you need to reflect your community. And if the school board doesn't listen, then the parents need to take a strong look at who they vote onto the school board the next election time.
Related to that, a lot of businesses complain that the people that they're getting to work in their companies don't have the skills that they need, and they look back at the schools to say maybe the schools aren't providing employees who are prepared to work. And I wanted to ask you, do you feel that there is an issue with regards to the infrastructure that is the bridge between schooling and work?
I think largely it is true. The community blames the school. The school, it's easy to blame the parents. And And I see where we could all improve, whether it's the community, the school district, or the parents. Our homes, we need to be doing a better job for our kids. And my wife and I raised 8 kids. We have 15 grandkids. Every one of my kids are productive, caring parents and adults, successful people. Our parents, our homes, there's no excuse. And I know parents may be jobless. They may even be homeless. They may be facing a lot of challenges. But when we take on the responsibility of raising a child, it's our responsibility. There's no excuse for us not making sure that that child's not prepared when they go out the door. I'm pretty hard on parents. I'm pretty hard on school districts, and I'm pretty hard on communities. And we all take a responsibility. And I do think that too many of our kids are graduating from high school without the ability to read, without the ability to show up for work on time, and some of those soft skills that businesses are saying, we're getting too many applicants that they don't get it. They don't understand that there's a personal responsibility issue, that they need to show up at work on time. They need to be clean. They need to be able to communicate with clients. And we're just not getting those kind of people. And that's aside from the STEM education that a lot of businesses are saying that we need to focus more on in middle school and high school.
Getting back to those larger state-related issues that I wanted to sort of get your thoughts on, several state governors have refused to issue ID cards to same-sex marriage partners in their state, National Guards, because it comes down to whether the state militia belongs to the governor, who is the commander-in-chief of the militia for the state, or whether the militia has to follow the dictates of the Supreme Court and federal supremacy. So my question has to do with what, as a state representative, do you think about the idea of, you know, same-sex marriage? And it's sort of related to the medical marijuana issue, because Oregonians can cross the border, get married in Washington, and then come back and not really know whether or not the status of their marriage is the same in Washington as it is in Oregon.
From a personal standpoint, as far as same-sex marriage, I've always been, you know, I was raised this way, and I have my own strong belief as an adult that it's between one man and one woman. So that's a personal belief issue. But at the same time, I'm not going to discriminate against anybody. I mean, I've always had a number of homosexual friends, and they're good friends, and I don't discriminate against them. If the state recognizes a partnership, which we have, and we, you know, they get the same health care benefits and stuff if one of them is a state employee, you know, I support that. If you're going to be joined together, you know, don't discriminate on benefits or whatever. The militia part, a lot of issues also, if they don't rise to a level of my constituents emailing me and saying, hey, I'm highly concerned about this issue, you know, I'm putting it on my radar screen, I've got enough issues that do rise to that level that I deal with on a daily basis. I probably don't give things a lot of thought if I don't have to. And as a legislator, I am extremely cautious when we start looking at changing the Constitution within the legislature. I mean, it always needs to go to a vote of the people. Personal beliefs aside, you know, your personal beliefs do play a role, but more times than not, they don't. It just has to do with, I'm probably not personally going to be bringing a bill to do X, where I think the voters have spoken on that a number of times.
That sort of gets me to the issue of judicial activism. Because a lot of people sort of have a concern that a judge who interprets a law rather than ruling on a law is actually doing the legislature's job. So I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, is that something that, as a member of the Oregon legislature, you've had to deal with?
In Oregon, it's been pretty minimal. There have been times when the Court of Appeals, for example, in Oregon, just this last legislative session on workman's comp, for example, with members of LLCs, we had to tweak the law to make clear what we felt the law said, but the Court of Appeals in Oregon said, no, that's not the way we read the law. probably from a court perspective in Oregon, it's more adjusting to a decision that they made in interpreting the law and going, whoa, okay, that's not what we felt the law said, and that's not what we want the law to be. We want certain protections, whether it's for businesses or kids or whatever. And so we set about and introduced a bill to try to have the law say what we really want it to say.
Okay. John Huffman is a Republican House member for the 59th District in Oregon. He's running for re-election, and I've had this opportunity to talk with him about his candidacy and his goal. Mr. Huffman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.
I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with Mark Garcia. Mr. Garcia is running for state representative in District 2 for the Oregon Legislature. Mr. Garcia, thanks for talking with me.
Good afternoon, Don. It's great to be here, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk to the voters.
You know, Tim Freeman is leaving the Oregon House to run for Douglas County Commission, and you ran for Douglas County Commission last year. This year, you're running for the House. Mr. Freeman seems to be looking for more of a local influence, and I'm just wondering, why are you choosing a state-level office instead?
Right. So I was not positive that I was going to run for office this go-around. I was looking at the county commissioner possibly and possibly state rep. But me and Tim had talked last year about what he was interested in doing, and I felt he was a stronger candidate to run for county commissioner. You know, we have the seats currently held by the Democrats. And I felt it was more important that we had the strongest candidate there to make sure we regain that seat at the county level, because it's a nonpartisan seat now, so it's much more difficult for the Republicans to control that seat than it is, say, the state representative position. So then I took a look at the state representative position for District Number 2 and felt that the remaining potential candidates, that I was a strong candidate, and I feel that I can provide some very good, if not the best, representation of Salem than anybody else that I know that might be considering that position.
On your website, you are running for District 2. District 2 covers Douglas and Jackson and Josephine counties in the southwestern part of the state. What are the issues for those folks in District 2?
Well, primarily it's jobs. All three of our counties are struggling with unemployment, primarily due to timber issues. So that is the number one concern with anybody that's living in any of the rural southwestern counties. Timber at the state representative level is not quite as important an issue as it is at the federal level, because that's where the bottleneck is. But we do have some opportunities to get the gas pipeline coming through, and obviously all three counties would benefit hugely if that were to happen.
So for the people who are looking, you know, at all the candidates running, what is it that makes your candidacy special?
Well, I have a lot of experience. I've participated at in government for a number of years now. So I bring a lot of experience working with a lot of diverse groups to the position. I also have a good record on conservative issues that voters care about, including the timber issue, including jobs issues like the gas pipeline, working with youth and education and things like that. So that's something, obviously, my opponent doesn't have that I bring to the table.
I was looking at some of the traditionally hot topics for Oregonians, and I wanted to sort of go through a list and get your thoughts on each one of them. And the first one is timber. Mm-hmm. You know, Oregon's gotten a lot of money in the past from its timber sales, but those sales are being cut back. And so the state is looking for other sources of revenue. And I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on timber sales?
So we have the Walden-Schrader-DePazio bill in the House, which would bring us up to about 500 million board feet from federal timberlands. And then we have Senator Wyden's plan, which is estimated around 300 million. Now, back in the late 80s, we were up right around 900 to 1.2 billion feet. And we figure we're producing about a billion board feet of timber of growth per year. So if we can get 500 million board feet, that's sustainable, and it will provide a significant amount more jobs than the 300 million board feet that Wyden's talking about. So what we really need to do is convince Senator Wyden that he needs to back the bill in the House. I mean, right now, he's continuing to push the federal government to essentially not harvest our timber on federal lands, and in lieu of that, provide payments to counties, which is fine for county government, but it doesn't do anything to help private sector jobs. And private sector jobs are more important than funding the county government.
It seems, though, that in some counties, they have really been devastated by the loss of that money. And so I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts regarding trying to help those communities find other sources of revenue, find other new revenue staples for their economies if you're not successful in getting an increase in the number of board feet for harvest?
Right. As state representative, I will push very hard to diversify our economy. I would love to see any kind of employment come into rural Oregon, from chemical plants to nuclear power plants to oil refineries, whatever it takes to put people in family-based jobs. But that's something that people have been working at now for 15 years and have not been successful at it. So timber harvesting remains our primary opportunity to address the unemployment problems in rural Oregon.
Another one of those hot-button topics for Oregon right now is medical marijuana. Now, right across the border in Washington, the state just legalized the use of marijuana for personal use and spent a lot of time setting up an infrastructure for retail outlets to sell marijuana as well as medical marijuana dispensaries. And as you know, Oregonians, you know, can just cross the border if they want, you know, to buy marijuana for their own use, whatever that use is. Meanwhile, Oregon has been pretty resistant to the idea of marijuana for either personal use or medicinal use. So I was wondering, what are your thoughts about the use of marijuana, the legalization of marijuana, and do you think it could be one of those revenue sources to help the state with its deficit?
No, I don't think it would be a substantial revenue source if it was legalized. I think you would end up spending a significant amount of any revenue that you generated from the sale of that dealing with increased law enforcement or medical help for those that are dealing with dependency, drug dependency, and such and so forth. I'm opposed to the legalization of marijuana. I understand that we do need a system in place to dispense medical marijuana for specific medical conditions, but I know from personal relationships that that system is being abused. These medical marijuana cards are easily accessible. This whole system is easily abused, and I would like to see the state legislature tighten down on the use of medical marijuana. Yes.
I want to ask you a little bit about taxes now. I was looking back at some of Oregon's past ballot measures that have gone through the legislature. And I was looking at ballot measures 66 and 67 in particular. 66 raised the amount of personal tax on households, and 67 raised the corporate minimum tax. And my assumption is that as a Republican, you know, taxes are a major concern for you.
Sure. We should never have passed those two measures. Certainly like to see them repealed. You know, just because I'm a Republican doesn't mean I don't want to see the state government adequately funded. But the way to do that is to increase revenue through a greater taxation base. That means more people having jobs, better jobs. That means more industry paying more taxes. And I think we can achieve that, but we can't increase taxes of people who are already paying taxes paid. We've got to broaden our base. We have opportunities with trade with Asia, China in particular, that we should be exploiting to the fullest. And we obviously are in a central position between Washington and California. I think there are opportunities to exploit our physical location on the West Coast that maybe we're not doing as well a job as we could. So if we could repeal that tax or provide tax incentives to companies to move to Oregon to set up shop, that'll help our revenue. And it will reduce the amount of pressure that's placed on our existing tax base and hopefully stop progressive and liberal thinkers from attempting to raise the tax rate on everybody else.
I want to ask you about that, about Oregon's position between Washington and California as it relates to our port facilities. And specifically, I wanted to ask you about labor issues. Now, Governor Kitzhaber has been instrumental in helping negotiate a deal between labor unions at Terminal 6. It took more than a year for two jobs to get moved. And what that did was spook one of the major shippers that represents about 75% of the terminal's business. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, earlier in the year, you know, the governor called a special session to try to get some concessions to keep Nike in the state.
Right.
Special concessions were given to Intel. And, you know, across the border in Washington, you know, people see what happened when union workers turned down a contract for Boeing, and now Boeing's being quartered from all over the country.
Right.
Those jobs are in jeopardy. So I guess the question I wanted to ask you is what do you think about that relationship between, you know, government and labor, and how do you see the legislature having a role in helping make that relationship a little smoother?
Sure. So I have a pretty deep appreciation for the relationship, and I would personally like to see the state legislature get more deeply involved in labor negotiations than they have currently been. And what that will do is bring a greater degree of accountability to labor contracts back into the hands of the public. One of the unfortunate things you have in government dealing with organized labor is that you often have conflicts of interest when administrators themselves are members of labor unions or recipients of PERS and things like that who have a vested interest. We could reduce or eliminate those conflicts of interest by having the legislature as a body have a greater participation in labor negotiations. One of the problems that labor has is that they have, you know, they've fought and won good contracts for themselves, for their members over the decades, and as they should, that's their job. But it's also the job of business, and in this case, government agencies, to fight for wages which either the business or the government can pay for, has the funds for. And as you know, everybody has suffered through this great recession. A state budget has not grown at the rates that it was growing previously. So everybody in the private sector has made concessions. And now everybody that I talk to in the private sector expects the public sector to share some of the burden of these cuts. And that's why we've had the two minor PERS reform initiatives passed, and it's why we need to find additional ways to reduce benefits and pay for those organized workers who are making in the top income at the state level. Obviously, not every public employee is making, you know, $50,000, $100,000 a year, but there are many that are, and those are the ones that we need to bring better balance between the public sector and the private sector.
I wanted to talk a little bit about that, too. In Michigan, as an example, the state can't afford to pay the high interest on the retirement accounts that the employees were guaranteed when the contracts were signed, when the state was doing economically much better. And so, I mean, I understand that contract law is supposed to be, you know, inviolate in the United States. But I mean, what happens when the state just can't make the budget?
Well, then they go into bankruptcy proceedings just like they've done in Detroit, and other entities like the federal government step in to address the issue. We don't want to find Oregon in that position 10 years from now, 20 years from now. So that is why we need to be renegotiating these contracts as they come up for renewal.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about Cover Oregon and the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act is recovering slowly, even though the rollout was pretty bad, and Cover Oregon is still having some significant issues. Mm-hmm. But there are still lots of Americans, millions of Americans don't have health care, thousands of Oregonians who don't have health care. And I wanted to ask you what you think needs to be done to help meet, you know, the needs of those people who are without health care. I mean, do you think it's a matter of making sure we do everything we can to make the programs that have been put in place work? Or do you think that, you know, the system that we had before these programs were adopted was better? I want to get some of your thoughts on that.
Right. I don't feel that that Cover Oregon or Obamacare or the path we're on now is financially viable. But there is a path, I believe, that Republicans ought to be looking at, and that is to follow the path that we used in the last century to deal with food. If you look at the turn of the 20th century, many people could not eat meat on a regular basis. Nutrition was a huge problem at the beginning of the century. If you look at the end of the 21st or the end of the 20th century and end of the 21st century, we have again a food problem, but it's an obesity problem. That's how successful the plans we put in place to deal with agriculture were last century. So we need to look at how we can transform the medical industry into a system which everybody can afford. And I think that comes down to the application of technology.
Well, let me ask you about that, because to use your example, I mean, one of the reasons why food became so plentiful in the United States during the period that you're talking about is because the food industry became industrialized, and the distribution systems became much more efficient. And one of the things I think that distinguishes the food distribution system from the healthcare distribution system is that people have personal relationships with their physicians. They're very particular about their care. They want extraordinary measures, even when the physicians may not necessarily agree with those measures. Healthcare is very, very personal. And I'm just curious, how would you use the same kind of industrializing techniques from the food industry to the healthcare industry, and at the same time give people the kind of individual attention that they feel that they need?
Right. Well, I mean, there's a price to pay for industrialization. If you go back to the 19th century, food production was very personal, too. Everybody grew their own food or knew who grew it. It was grown locally. And we had to make sacrifices in terms of, you know, you can call that quality of food, to get that industrialization to solve the hunger problems that we had. And I just don't feel that we can afford to have that personal relationship between the patients and doctors and even nurses for that matter, that we've historically had. It's just too expensive. And honestly, I suspect that the younger generations will be more open to a change in the way medical care is distributed.
You know, young people are young until they're not, and then all of a sudden, they have the same kind of concerns as their parents and grandparents, because they have bodies too, and their bodies get old, and knees start to hurt, and their back injuries and eye problems. And every generation feels it's invincible until it realizes it isn't anymore. I mean,
absolutely. Imagine this, for example. Let's say 20 years down the road, when you have a 25-year-old person who has medical devices either in their smartphone, implanted, sensing devices at home that has real-time monitoring of every vital statistic you can imagine. And that person would know more about their medical situation than anyone alive today. And they would have control over that. I'm obviously not suggesting that we turn it over to Big Brother so that they can monitor you like the NSA does or emails. That's not what I'm suggesting.
I want to switch gears now and talk a little bit about the schools. There is an issue with some parents in Portland public schools. They've accused the school system of not teaching their children according to the way schools are mandated to teach them for the amount of time they're mandated to teach them for. And I wanted to ask you, you know, what are your thoughts regarding that? Because the state does have a responsibility, according to the state constitution, to provide free education to the children of the state.
Obviously, I have a pretty good feeling of what's going on here in Douglas County. When No Child Left Behind was passed, that was a watershed moment in our education system. Prior to that, these kinds of problems were not dealt with. The system was failing, and nobody was paying much attention to the education system. And nobody had a means to address it. Now, since then, you know, the conservative right has had a crack at it. And then when the Obama administration came in, they put in their own programs and changed it, and they've had a crack at it. And now I think we're at the point where everybody has a very good understanding of the problems within the education system, and they have the tools to address those problems. So the education system is improving. My daughter now is in high school. She's a junior. And while there are some issues that I still have problems with in high school, I think that her level of education is much better than what my son's was 10 years prior to that, and certainly better than what my education was back in the early 80s. So we're making progress, but there's going to continue to be fighting over a limited set of dollars.
Related to that, a lot of businesses complain that the people they're getting from the schools to who come to work in their companies don't have the skills they need. And those companies look at the schools. Those companies look at the schools and say that they aren't providing employees that are ready to work. And so I wanted to ask you, do you feel that there is an issue with regards to the infrastructure, what some people call a skills gap? Do you think there's a skills gap in the bridge between school and work?
No, I do not. Although I do feel that there's a gap with the work ethics in our culture today. And I think that's really the real issue because, you know, the vast majority of jobs are out there that are not skills that somebody can't learn on the job in a few weeks or in a few months in some cases. What kids need out of high school is a general understanding of concepts that they'll have to apply in specific jobs, like math and English. They need to be able to read. Those are not job-specific skills. Those are general skills that they need to have. But really, I think the problem we're running into is an issue of culture. Many kids today, I think, come out of high school, they're not seeing opportunities for them to go find jobs that are family wage jobs that pay $25, $35 an hour. You know, they're seeing service industry jobs at McDonald's for $10 an hour. And that's a problem. And I realize that some people feel that new workers entering the workforce should just take what they can get and be happy with that. But you can't raise a family on minimum wage jobs. Those are meant for people holding second jobs or youth still in high school perhaps or retirees possibly that already have a second income. They're not head of household type of jobs. So when you don't have opportunities and you don't have people wanting or able to take non-family wage jobs and live off of that, you have a serious problem. So our job as state legislatures is to transform the state such that we do have employment opportunities where a person can go and get a job that pays enough to raise a family on.
You know, I'm listening to you, and I'm comparing in my mind what you're saying to some of the things I've heard some other candidates and potential candidates say. And now, on your website, you bill yourself as a compassionate conservative. So I wanted to ask you, what does that mean, considering how different you are from some of your colleagues and colleagues-to-be?
Right. Well, you said it. That compassionate means that I care about, you know, you have to care about the poor as well as you do the middle class or the wealthy. You have to be willing to look at human nature and not how the idealized individual ought to be, because that's not the way people are. People face difficulties in their life from time to time, and they can't live up to all the expectations that everybody, that we would like to. You know, as a Christian, I feel that sometimes the far right is too hard on people who are not meeting the expectations that they expect that they should be. And so that's where that compassion comes in.
I want to go back to some of those state issues that I was touching on earlier. I wanted to get your thoughts on this issue that's come up with regards to the governors of some states refusing to issue ID cards to same-sex marriage partners in their state National Guards. And that has caused a conflict between the governors, who are the commanders-in-chief of their state militia.
And you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. Happy New Year to all our KBOO members. The time is 6:58. Hard Knock would usually be on tonight, but we're going to go ahead and play a little music for you. So we'll start up with some blues and just flow. So stay tuned right after these messages.
KBOO Community Radio and the North Portland Neighborhood Library is proud to sponsor the Jefferson High School 13th Annual Multicultural Film Festival. On January 14th, the documentary The House I Live In explores the risks that prohibition poses to freedom and the tragedy of addicts being treated as criminals. Meanwhile, the prisons of America are growing overcrowded with nonviolent criminals and illegal drugs are still being sold in schoolyards. This film is being shown on January 14th at the North Portland Neighborhood Library off of Killingsworth Street at 6 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
suitcase, put my misery inside, throw away the pain and trouble that I felt for all my life. Well, now I'm trying to tell you people that the blues hit me in my life. And it's a hard, hard road till the day.